You know, Don, Michelle, we are in the midst of the Under Armour Mountain Running Series. Are you familiar with that is? What that is, Michelle?
Yeah, there's something for everyone, all different distances, and you can even do every distance if you want to be a savage rock star and participate every day.
A couple weeks ago, they just did the one called the Cascade Volcano, which was up at Mount Bachelor, Oregon, at the end of July. And they have the one called Appalachians coming up in Killington, Vermont on August 18th through the 20th. And they have seven different distances. They have a 5K, a 10K, a vertical challenge, a marathon relay, a half marathon, a marathon, and a 50K. And it goes through those 3 days, and it's like this ultra running festival.
Sounds like a party.
It is.
It sounds like an American version of UTMB that we're about to learn about. Yeah, it's a festival and a party.
So they have the one in Killington, Vermont at the end of August, and then at the end of September, they do the Rocky Mountains, which is held at Copper Mountain, Colorado.
That's beautiful. Which,
I think that's going to be a lot of fun. If you want to register for one or, as Michelle's going to do, for all of these races, you can go to our partners page, and there's a link there for the Under Armour Mountain Running Series. If you click on that and use the code TRNATION, you can get 20% off the registration.
And if you show up in a pair of Under Armour Horizons, now that's their new trail shoe, Scott, you can get to the front of the line, and they'll stop the time as soon as you hit the finish line. Tailwind Nutrition, you know, it's not always easy running these long, long miles on hot, hot days, but you know what makes it easier? A good drink to replenish that stuff you're losing, and that's Tailwind Nutrition.
Yeah, and you want something that absorbs quick, that's easy on your gut, that tastes good. Tailwind has that kind of a savory, salty flavor that actually tastes really good after drinking miles and miles of it.
It's like drinking grandma's lemonade, ice cold.
Ice cold grandma's lemonade. I think we're going to have a little discussion with Tailwind to change the name.
I think it's like getting a warm hug from my grandma.
I'll tell you, down a few aid stations into a race, I could sure use a hug from grandma. That's for sure, Scott.
And you can buy Tailwind Nutrition a number of different ways. If you go to their website, tailwindnutrition.com, they have the big packages that you can train with. They have the stick pack bundles, or you can just buy the stick packs, and those are the really easy ones you can stash in your hydration vest. And just rip, dip, and go.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will, the Group of the Nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Any other questions? I'm sorry. Who has those? Sally?
Yeah, there's a bunch on most of them are Instagram, and there's some on my Yellow Runner Facebook page.
Okay.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Sally McCray.
Yeah, just anybody that wants to
I'm
speak
Michelle
up.
Barton.
Michelle Barton. Tim.
I'm Scott War.
And?
And I'm Tim Tolleson.
All right. Well,
and welcome to our UTMB extravaganza.
I think we have this world, the United States rounded up. I mean, we have people from all over the United States today.
And we're not even talking about the United States. And that's really the purpose of this podcast. We have two athletes, and you can guess who they are. It's not Michelle, Scott, or Don that's going to UTMB. And here in America, we talk a lot about our races, you know, Western states, Hard Rock, Vermont, and we get very American-centric. But there's something else going on that's very, very big over in Europe and makes our race look quite small. And so we thought we'd dive into that with a couple of athletes that are headed there now that have named it their A race, some athletes that have stood on the podium at those very races, and we just want to get down to figuring out what's all the excitement about in Europe. So with that, Michelle, you've been tasked with kind of putting this podcast together. And we do not want to step on your toes. I believe you have some details about Tim that are going to surprise some people that may not know what it is.
This is scary.
Yeah, listen to this, Tim.
You want to start with Tim? Well, let's start with the race. So UTMB is arguably one of, it's regarded as one of the most difficult foot races in Europe. And it's also one of the biggest ultramarathons in the world, with over 2,200 starters in the 100 miler, which is actually 170K, and over 8,000 runners in all five of the races. So last year, Tim's 100 mile debut, and he happens to crush it and come in third overall. And that was pretty amazing.
Congratulations.
It was a lucky
Tim.
Day.
Oh, I
Thank
don't think there's no luck involved in that, that's for sure.
So really quick, I mean, and maybe you can pause this and put this question further down in the pot. The one thing that I think is amazing about UTMB is it's not just one race. It's like a mm-hmm. whole bunch of races that last an entire week. Is that right?
Yeah. Sally.
Yeah, it's really neat. The fact that it's an entire just sort of, you know, 5-day event that people can go to, participate in, cheer for, or just support. And it's unlike something that we have in the States. You know, it's just this carnival, basically, of 5 days of just, you know, kind of madness, but passionate fans all throughout Chamonix. And it's you can just feed off the energy every single day leading up to kind of the pinnacle full 170-kilometer loop around Mont Blanc.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of that excitement and some of those fans, some casual non-running type fans that are out there, because typically at our races we either see a family member or somebody that's running a race that's had a bib on. But by the looks of the crowd there, it draws all kinds of people.
Yeah, European racing is it's very different from the States as far as, I guess, like how seriously the people take it over there. I feel like people are incredibly passionate about it. And even just, you know, your everyday runner, like the way that they dress even. I mean, they're like, they're kitted out. Like, you know, I feel like Americans were a lot more laid back. You know, we run with maybe a water bottle and a dirty chucker hat and maybe some shorts. And, you know, like, it's a very different atmosphere. And there it's like they have like everybody has a uniform. And, you know, with UTMB, it's like it could be 2 a.m. in the morning and there are fans in the middle of the forest, like for miles. And it's really exciting. It's the buzz and the spirit of it all. They take it very seriously. They take a lot. There's a lot of pride in the actual race. And it's incredibly exciting, I think, for Americans to go over and experience that, because you really don't get that a lot here in our local races.
For sure. It has much more of the feel of what we would view like a major city marathon, like you know, Chicago or Boston or New York. You know, it's that passionate of like of a crowd base and that many people all along the course. And like what Sally was saying, tons of spandex and tons of light.
Oh my God, it's so much. Like, and white spandex.
Yeah. So if I can ask, how are you received as American trail runners? Do they even acknowledge that or give you a high five or hand you a pair of white spandex?
Yeah, I think I got a couple of pairs of white spandex that I had to wash first. But we had heard. Well, so speaking from my experience, the first time in 2015 going over there for CCC, we kind of heard that, you know, there was this. I don't know if it was really a big rivalry, but like there wasn't a lot of respect necessarily for American trail runners doing well at the, at least particularly, I should say, for men, you know, like Rory Bossio and so like, drawing a blank right now. Oh, Chrissy Moll, you know, obviously they're UTMB champs, but the men had historically struggled a little bit more. There were still great performances. We had, you know, second, third, fourth places, but they were kind of strung out, never real consistent. And, but what we found, I think Zach, Laney, and myself, was that people got excited that the Americans were doing well again. And, like along the course, you have little flags on your bibs to say which country you're from. And when like Zach and I were leading CCC 2 years ago, people were shocked and then super just like jazzed that they're like Americans, like they were surprised that there were Americans in the front and they got super, super excited. So I don't think there was any animosity towards us. And then coming back the next year or last year, 2016, I think it was more, okay, like this is pretty cool. We have some Americans coming back and there were some storylines kind of that they could play into a little bit more. But I think we were welcomed, you know, with open arms both years.
I mean, I think somebody on Instagram may have put this up as a question. They were asking about how do Europeans treat the Americans or whatever. You know, when it comes down to it, they really take they're welcome to sports. I mean, you take pride in your athletes, you take pride in your home trails. So, you know, when you come into an aid station, they're probably going to help out their athletes first. And sometimes that does happen, but you know, I don't see that as, I'm not offended by that. I think that, you know, it's just them taking pride in their own athletes. And my experience every time I race overseas quite a bit, I'm always well received, and I love, you know, every race that I've done, and the aid stations have been great and organizers have been great. And a lot of times you see them being so grateful that we make the trip out there to do their race because it's paying respect to it. So, you know, there's going to be that rivalry, you know, among elites from different countries. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, we as competitors, we expect that. So it's, we don't look at it as a negative thing. If anything, it fuels us too.
So Tim, this is your third trip over?
This will be, yeah.
And Sally, this is your third trip.
It is.
What is the one thing, question to both of you, what is one of the things that surprised you the most about the race that maybe you weren't prepared for?
Go ahead.
Like cheese and meat at the aid stations.
Yes.
Like, you know, like the smorgasbord of like fine cheeses where you want to eat it, but you know that it's just going to wreck your stomach if you do. So it, I almost hoped that my race went poorly so that I could then really just kind of wine and dine myself through each little station.
Are there people eating the cheese and the meat?
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yep. It's like, it'll be like a big box of sausage. Like, you're like,
so,
yeah.
What's your guys' nutrition strategy for the race? Like, are you bringing everything over? Like, I know Tim, you're with Goo Energy, and like Sally, you have that McRecovery. Like, tell me about that. And do you use that for fuel or for recovery? And what is that?
You know, for me, and like I said, I travel a lot racing. And so yeah. I think the most important thing that I've learned over the years is eating real food is very helpful if you are going to be doing a lot of international races, because you're actually training your body how to fuel on real food. And most of the races have real food at the tables. So if you can teach your body how to do well on potatoes and bananas and, you know, bread and having crackers and soup, which most everywhere I've been will have that stuff. One race that I do in Italy every year, it's just lemons and raisins, and I'm able to get by on that. Lemons and raisins. But I think for me, like my nutrition, I use Spring. It's made up of all real food, and you only get to see the first, I don't know, you get one drop bag at UTMB. So if you don't, if you don't have crew, you actually, like, you can only carry so much food with you until you get to that drop bag. And then you can only carry so much food with you for then. So for me, my strategy has been, okay, I'm going to carry what I can until I see my crew and carry a little bit more, but I should be able to find something throughout the aid stations.
Right.
Also going to help me. And so that's why I'm such a big believer on real food and not so dependent on having a certain powder, a certain gel. you know, it just, that just helps with my strategy. So yeah, I'll carry my spring, but I'll also be eating at the aid stations too.
How about you, Tim? Yeah. Why don't you address that as far as unfamiliar food at the aid stations?
Yeah, I think Sally makes a great point that if you can kind of practice training yourself with a variety of different foods that, you know, or maybe do a little research and see what the particular country is going to offer at that race, it's a good idea because, you know, your nutrition plan may be, oh, I'm only going to use goo product or I'm only going to use, you know, this other product. And then something happens and, you know, whatever it may be, you don't have it, you need to adapt. So I think having those backup plans is great. Personally, for both UTMB races, I was fortunate to have a crew with me that, you know, allowed me to use what I wanted throughout the race. So I, both times, CCC and UTMB, I was pretty much only using goo products, a mixture of kind of their drink mixes, the Roctane drink mixes, and then a lot of chews and a few Stroopwafels. So a little bit of real food, but pretty much I wasn't really eating anything other than that. But I did have an experience at Trans Gran Canaria a couple years ago in Spain that went really poorly. And that one, I did start to rely on their aid stations. And I was actually eating cheese and meats and making little sandwiches. I had a bowl of pasta like halfway through. And it was just kind of trying to see if something could save my race, but it was to no avail. But, you know, I think it's nice to be able to adapt, definitely. So
you with going, if you're racing the 100-mile distance, the actual UTMB, you go through three countries. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So is there, are in each of those countries, is the aid station food different?
I think it was pretty consistent.
I think so too.
And all those, they all kind of eat the same way. I mean, similarly, I mean, they do rely on the meats, the cheeses, the bread, and there's a ton of chocolate and cookies. Oh my gosh. There's so much sugar in the aid stations. Yeah. It's ridiculous. So yeah. I don't think that really changed. I think like in the later stages, you see more soup, a little bit more like heavier foods, but that's kind of the same way it is here for 100. It's like you get heavier food as 100 goes on, you know, you can get a grilled cheese or eggs or whatever.
Yeah. And all of them thankfully had Coke, which was a staple for myself. And as Sally said, like during the night stages, I know for me, I was going through, I had just entered into Italy and I was eating a lot of soup at their aid stations. And that was pretty heavenly.
I just want to go back to Sally's comment a second ago. Raisins and lemons. Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
lemons.
That sounds horrible, dude.
It sounds like a recipe for, you know, dialing out of a race in about a half a mile.
I know. Like acid and fiber. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Really good friends with the race directors, and I was there for their inaugural year, and I told him, I was like, wait, you're seriously putting out lemons? And she's like, yes, it's like one of our main products of this part of Italy. Like, people love them, and people eat them. I mean, there are, like, good elements of lemons, like the antioxidants or anti-inflammatories that you get from eating them. But like, it is just not something that I've ever been used to or wanted to grab in the middle of a race, especially when you're running hard. Like, give me that sour lemon. Like, no.
You know what I need right now is a lemon, a real sour lemon.
Can we talk about the race a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Can we talk about the food of the country? So Sally and Tim are going to run through Switzerland and Italy and France. And the race has 10,000 meters of gain, which is equivalent to over 32,000 feet of climbing. That's pretty massive. Plus, you guys, it's a 6 p.m. night start, which is another thing. Like, how do you guys prepare? Or what's the strategy for that?
That's a tough one. I think you need to do well with sleep deprivation. Like, there's no way around it. I didn't prepare for that particularly. You know, I think it's tough too. It's, you know, if you can practice definitely running with a headlamp at some point, that's important. You know, you're going to be tired, right? You know, so you just, maybe you practice, you know, running on tired legs a lot, but, and I guess for me, working full time and then training, that's kind of a way to practice always running on tired legs. But you know, getting used to running with a headlamp on technical terrain or up and down steep climbs, that's definitely something worthwhile, you know, because you can get that tunnel vision. And when you're all night long with the headlamp, it's a bit different than, you know, maybe just a 4 a.m. start when you have 2 hours with a headlamp. But it is a unique thing. And I know I don't nap. Like, I've never been a napper. So I wake up at 6 a.m. and you don't race till 6 p.m. So you've already been up for 12 hours and then you're going into a 20 to 46 hour race. It's kind of intense. And I think it's something that the people at the back of the field are definitely probably utilizing some of those kind of cots throughout the aid stations where they might be napping. They might, you know, take a power nap. And so I think it's something to factor in when you're training or planning your race strategy, knowing that, okay, it might not only take me 45 hours of running, I will have already been up for however many hours in the day that you began. So
basically for both of you, you don't just like force yourself to stay in the hotel room and chill until like 4 p.m. Like you, once you're up at 6 a.m., like that's just it. That doesn't change and you're going to be up for like two nights.
I know for me personally, that was like, I hung out with, like David and Zach last year and we had lunch and I saw my parents and just kind of putzed around, tried to keep my feet up for the most part. And I attempted to nap, but being that I had never taken naps, it was, it was sort of pointless, but, so that was my personal strategy for it.
Yeah. I like to stay, I'll stay off my feet and I will nap. And I think in prep for it too, like I just do a lot more night running. I think what Tim said, it is crucial to practice with a headlamp and just get used to running at night. Yeah. Just anyway. But yeah, that 6 PM start it's different. It kind of gets you.
And there's a lot of rules, like, especially for the night running, like, don't you have to carry like a mandatory couple headlamps with backup batteries in your pack and all kinds of things?
You gotta carry like a truckload of stuff at all times.
Yeah. Like, in your 30-pound pack, you have like 16 headlamps and backup batteries.
And backup batteries.
And three lemons and some raisins.
Let's talk about that. What is mandatory in your that you have to carry? I'm interested.
How about we just talk about what we don't have to carry? And that'll be months. Tim, let's tackle this. As far as clothes go, what do we got?
So you have a waterproof jacket, waterproof pants, long sleeve shirt, long sleeve tights, waterproof gloves, warm gloves, a beanie, a hat or a buff, two headlamps with backup batteries for both. Wow. Space blanket, a certain amount of length of emergency bandage, a whistle, minimum of 1.5 liters water carrying capacity, food storage.
A pacer.
You have to. A cell phone fully charged with the emergency numbers that works in all three countries.
The international plan.
Yeah. And pacers are not allowed.
If you start with poles, you have to end with poles.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah.
And you can only start with them. You can't get them halfway.
Exactly. So it's start and finish with them. Are we forgetting? There might
gloves?
Be some other things.
You have to carry gloves.
He said gloves. I can't believe all this came right off the top of Tim's head. He didn't have to. He wasn't looking at a whiteboard or he was just rolling right off his tongue.
Yeah. I think I was just so shocked at how much we had to carry. It burned in the back of my memory.
But I will say, Ultra Trail Australia, Tim, we had to carry more.
We actually did, which was surprising. Yeah.
Literally had to carry. The most hilarious thing was the night vest, like the big reflective vest.
Yeah, the workman's vest.
The workman's vest.
Like a crossing guard vest.
That's what you have to take at Badwater. How strange.
It was so much stuff. Like, I had to borrow Tim's pack. Yeah. I was like, do you have a bigger pack? I wore his pack.
Yeah.
So do you use all of that stuff or do you use a portion of it?
So I think it really depends on the athlete. Like last year at UTMB, and Sally will have a totally different experience than I did. Fortunately, my race was over at about 4:30 p.m. the following day before nightfall. So I didn't need another set of headlamps or batteries and Sally could go into it. But we finished under good weather conditions, and then a torrential downpour thunderstorm rolled in that night. So I didn't need anything. I didn't use any of my waterproof gear. I didn't, like, during the night, I got a little cold, but I still was just in split shorts and a singlet, and I didn't use any gear. I just had to carry it. But Sally, on the other hand, I think did use some of hers.
Yeah, I did. I had a pretty terrible race last year, and I ended up getting, I think it was around mile 80-ish, but I did get caught in a thunderstorm at the top of one of the climbs. Mm-hmm. And I was in my waterproof pants and jacket. I was really cold. I was sick, so I actually had on, I think, all my jackets. but it was, yeah, it was. But the year before that, too, all that I've ever used is a headlamp, a jacket, and I think maybe the gloves the first year. But that's about it. I've never used the rest of it. But, you know, most overseas racing has a lot of required gear. I've done, like, the 50K that I did in Italy. There was so much gear I had to carry for that. And, but, you know, race directors, they, and I guess more just European races, if anything happens to a runner, usually the race director or the race is actually takes the blame. And so regardless of how much that you are well informed, or, you know, how much they tell you, how well it's marked, if something happens to a runner, then the race is usually, you know, a lot of times they take the blame for it. So, you know, they want to be respectful of everybody that's out there. And so if somebody's out there for 40 hours, you're going to end up using probably a lot of that stuff. So it's just being respectful of the race and the mountain.
Yeah. And that's I think that's a great point. You know, you really have to be respectful of the mountainous conditions where things change on a dime. You know, we could have a bluebird day and then suddenly a thundercloud or a storm rolls through and you could get caught in a hailstorm or, lightning storm. And you really need to be prepared for those quick varying conditions. So I think being erring on the side of caution is nice. Sometimes it feels kind of ridiculous, especially if you don't need the gear. But the worst thing is getting caught in those situations without necessary gear. You know, in some situations it could be, you know, life or death. So it's better to just be prepared for that.
Yeah, now,
you said jokingly it was a 30-pound pack, and I imagine it's probably close to 30 pounds. I'm curious, do you train with a pack since you have to carry a pack during the race? Do you get out there and do some training runs with a similar weighted pack?
I personally do, and I think it's a really good idea to do that. Before my first trip over there in 2015, Tim Olson gave me some pointers and a few other people, and they said, hey, put on your pack, get out there and run with it, you know, practice, because it changes the dynamic of how you're training. You know, if you have just a little handheld water bottle or a waist belt, you feel like you can rip like all the descents, or like you're just flying on the uphills. But you put on maybe a 5 to 10 pound pack, depending on what you have, it really, you know, kind of changes it. And I think getting used to that both mentally and physically is like, it pays huge dividends. So for me personally, I probably do all of my big long runs with my fully loaded pack. And practice with my poles and just kind of go through different things like, okay, am I going to use my poles? Am I going to stash them? How am I going to stash them? Like, how am I going to access something if it does start to rain? You know, kind of go through those things in a training situation where if I fumble and I really like screw up or I drop everything out of my pack, you know, you can kind of hopefully remediate those problems and not be in the race situation and suddenly just freak out because something was thrown at you sideways and you can't handle it. So I think trying to minimize those little, you know, variables in training is important.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I do the same thing. I practice with a pack, and I even have a couple different weight vests that sometimes I'll add with that, just to more of like a mental training. But one of the things that's important too, and especially for anyone that's going over there to race this, is to practice where you put that stuff in your pack too. Like that's key, because there is stuff in there that you're going to want to be able to access on the fly. And so just putting stuff always in the same spot in your pack is really important. And then learning, if you're using poles, how are you going to eat and drink consistently with poles? Like, what does that look like? Are you folding up your poles every time? Or are you going to carry them extended the entire time? Can you put two poles in one hand and eat and drink? How are you opening up your packages? Like, little stuff that you might not always think about, but all of that adds time and even can add frustration if you haven't practiced and figured that out.
So I have a question. Mm-hmm. Over here in the United States, there's not a lot of races that are, you know, that are, they even allow poles. And so, and there's some that do. And one of the reasons that we hear, at least on our trails, is, well, it's dangerous. You know, people will stab one another with poles. We can't be trusted with poles. You know, we're not smart enough to carry them around.
We're
others.
So American.
Yeah, oh, we have an angry society.
Such an American thing to say. Yeah.
So my question is, when you have 2,200 people and 4,400 poles, I mean, how many people do we see along the side of the trail with poles through them? I mean,
there are a lot of people with stabbed. Eye patches.
Yeah.
Ouch.
No, there are rules though. I mean, I've even seen it on some of the sites of how you're supposed to carry them. Like if you're not using, like you're not using them, like actually on the trail, you're just running with them.
Yeah.
Like the pointing part, you should have pointing forward, not back. So your handle should be pointed at the person behind you. And then, you know, you also want to keep them just like closer to your body. And if you don't have them pointed straight back or straight forward, then you should be holding them like straight up and down. Most poles collapse. So if you know you're going to hit, like UTMB has some really long downhill stretches. So if you're going to get a really long downhill stretch where you maybe technically don't really need the poles, fold them up and put them away and take them out when you really need them. But I'd say for the most part, like the last couple of years I've raced UTMB, people are pretty respectful with their poles. Like, yeah, you are going to get tripped here and there in the beginning. Like there, you know, you hear the clanking of these poles all over the rocks and it's crazy. But, you know, I think that everyone is, they're aware of each other and everyone, you just adapt, you know, there's poles out there. So deal with it. But, you know, you don't hear a lot of people getting their eyes poked out.
No.
I want to ask Sally and Tim, what percentage of the race do you use the poles? They're tucked away during a certain part you're using, and what percentage use, not use?
So I ended up holding my poles the entire race last year. I never put them away. Uh-huh. I started with them broken up into the three pieces in one hand. And I would just switch them back and forth in my hands, kind of like you would with a handheld water bottle. Right. They're actually lighter than a water bottle, so you don't even notice it. Mm-hmm. But I started using them probably on the first climb around, I don't know, mile 5 or 6. And then I would use them on almost every single climb. I kind of enhanced my power hiking. And then on the descents, where I was in the race, there weren't many people around me. So I was able just to leave them fully extended. And I would just carry them in one hand on the long descents. And I never put them away. This year, I do plan on probably stashing them. I'm working with Hoka on a pack that has a little quiver system that I can just throw them on the back of my pack and not have to worry about it. So I could have two hands free, but I used them pretty much every single climb. Yep.
Huh. Yeah. Same here. That's about the place that I used them to, about 5-6 miles in. The long stretches, I use that fuel belt. I don't know if you guys have seen it before. It's in a couple of the pictures that I just posted. It's a purple belt, but it has like little tiny pockets, like slits in them, and the folded up poles actually fit inside and it like does not move. So if I know I'm going to hit a long stretch of downhill, then I'll just fold them up, tuck them in there and have my hands free. So, but I've been practicing more kind of like what Tim does, like trying to see if I don't have to put them away, just because I hate folding them up and putting them in, taking it out. Like I just start adding up the seconds that takes me in.
Yeah. And I think for some people that are out there, you know, for the adventure and for the challenge, and they're not necessarily concerned about cutting seconds off their time, you know, then take the moment to stop, unzip your pack or put them in where you want to make sure it's all set. You know, I think it's better than getting uncomfortable or fumbling around or like having a pole fall out or something like that. You know, taking the few, you know, 30 seconds to a minute that may be required is totally worth it.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like neither of you use the poles on the downhills, only on the uphills. What about the flats?
So I would say there were a few times where on the downhills I did probably use them because I had them in my hand. And if it's kind of technical,
treacherous.
Yeah, like you can stabilize yourself a little bit more and unweight your hips, you know, so that it takes some of that load off of your muscles. So, but and then there are a few areas where even on flats, like, I get into a rhythm where I'm running, I kind of just like tap my poles on the ground as I'm running through. And it's not really assisting you at all. It's almost just this rhythmic kind of pattern that you kind of fall into. But I never do it intentionally. It almost just happens sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Same on all of that.
Yeah. Stop Michelle, copying me.
I know. Yeah,
I've noticed that. We didn't even need to have Sally on this podcast.
He really didn't.
How are you guys specifically like tweaking your training for UTMB since it has so much gain and it's known to be so technical? So are you focusing more on like vertical and finding more technical trails than just like overall weekly mileage, like hitting a number? Or how are you doing that?
Mm-hmm. You go, Sally.
Wait, okay. Yeah. Let's make Sally go so
Sally,
you can say
yes.
Same.
I'm just gonna say what she said.
Yeah,
I've
just
seen
say
Sally
same.
Well, you're gonna laugh because Tim and I have the same coach, but I don't think that.
Sally, I've seen you do like 3 repeats to the peak on Baldy and stuff. Like that's gnarly. That's a lot of vert.
You know, I actually, when I first started working with Mario, he actually took me out of the mountains, which is funny because when I was working with Ann Trayson, she did the same thing to me. I love the mountains so much. I would be in them all day, every single day, but it isn't always work well. I mean, like for my goals and what I need to be doing, I need to be getting faster. I need to be doing a lot more speed work. So my coach has me do pretty much what I guess, what you're doing for a road marathon. You know, I have to do the mile repeats and hill repeats and intervals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then on the weekends, we're doing some pretty big monster climbs, which I love. That's my favorite. So every weekend I do a 50K, and on that one, on one day, and it'll usually have anywhere between 8,000 and 9,000 feet of climbing. And it's pretty much run as much as you can. And then he will advise whether like what to do specifically on the downhill. So sometimes it's take the downhill easy, or sometimes it's, you know, run the downhill hard. But I like right now there isn't, I mean, I think my train's a little bit different from it is last year, just cause I have a different coach. But I run about 100-ish miles a week. And then have, you know, I have a hill day. I have a couple days a week where I'm doing either intervals or repeats, fartleks. And then on the weekend is just really big miles, big climbing in the mountains. So I'm actually not in the mountains as much as I was last year. I think I was in the mountains almost every day. But I feel like I'm fitter than I was last year because of it. And it's just, I like that, the approach that he has. It's just been better training, so.
And it seems like last year you were doing a lot more strength, and you know what I mean? Like all those kind of like weights and things. Yeah. Maybe you're not doing that as much this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the athlete that I've always been. I usually am in the gym 4 to 5 days a week, but probably like in the last like 5 months, I've probably only been in the gym about 3 days a week. My training just looks a little bit different, but I still do spend a lot of time on like body weight exercises, yoga, just keeping my body, like the base of my body strong. So it's just more running. Like I couldn't hit 100 milers consecutively the way I have been. Like this is my first time in my life I've been able to do that. So with that, I'm just spending more time running. My training is just, it's just a different approach. So, you know, praying that it'll pay off.
Right. So you feel like you're better trained this year going into it rather than last year?
Yeah. Well, at this time too, like I was pretty sick the last 5 months of last year. And I know someone even on social media asked me this question. They said something about my weight, which isn't really super different, but I had like a parasite last year going into UTMB and then into the 2 races after I did UTMB. So I got on the podium 5 times last year, but I did not have good performances. And UTMB, I took about 5 like anti-diarrhea pills before I started to try and help things along. Yeah. And then halfway through the race, those pills didn't work anymore. So I just became weaker and I was pretty sick. And I probably could have walked to this finish line, but I wanted to exercise having a little bit of grace on myself and just say, go get better, get well. And I pretty much just, I dropped out of the race. I was in a really bad place. So this right. year going in, I don't have a stomach parasite. I just feel better. My diet's changed a little bit. My training's changed. And, you know, every year that I start, I'm always looking at ways to get better. I think that I always have a lot that I can improve on as an athlete and just as a woman in general. And so any way that I can learn and grow, I'm always looking for that. So I'm really fortunate to have people like Mario and my sponsors in my corner who have helped guide me, you know, just along the way.
Did we lose Tim or did his camera fall?
I dropped my phone, but I think I'm back.
Yeah, he's
okay.
So somewhere good. I read that like both Sally and Tim said that UTMB was their hottest race. But then again, you know, you have where it can be freezing. Like I heard of one person actually died of hypothermia one year. And like, you know, you have the lightning storms or rain and I mean, where they'll hold you at the aid stations because it's so dangerous. So you can have the heat and the cold. And
yeah, I don't, it's not the hottest race. I mean, last year I got sunburned and got caught in a storm in the same place. But yeah, no, it's, you get all different types of weather systems, but being from Southern California, I mean, we have the luxury of being able to practice in heat weather all the time, but you know, I'm going to actually rewind because I know a lot of people want to know what Tim is doing in his training. And I think I took up a little time. So Tim, you go ahead and share what you're doing in training.
So I basically do what Sally does. I just do 1 mile more.
Yeah, good. And you want to be the best athlete and woman you can be,
yes,
which
you
is
know,
what I caught her saying.
As a female athlete that I really, you know, take care of those things.
But, yes.
Trains very hard. He's a hump guy about that, but
I joke with my wife that, I gut myself in training so that in races I can just enjoy myself. And it's like, no, you got to gut yourself in race. I'm like, well, yeah, but that's like my reward for all the hard training of the months and months. And like, that's your time to like treat yourself to just like a lap around the mountain. And so my training this year, I've changed it a bit in the sense that coming from a road and a track background, you know, really focusing on short, fast stuff. It was important to me that I didn't just suddenly flip the switch and jump into just hiking all the time. And Mario, he's been great about that, you know, kind of transitioned me slowly over the last couple of years into more of like a mountain-based athlete. And last year at UTMB, I think we probably, like I asked for it, but I think I was too fit of a runner going into UTMB last year and not quite strong enough as like a power hiker or like the steep vert or the cumulative vert and that the race offers. And by the latter stages, I was having a hard time on the uphills, staying up with people, but on the downhills, which has always been my favorite, I was able to kind of rip it and kind of just let it go. But, so this year it's changed a bit where we have focused more on increasing my total vert, per week and not focusing as much on my total mileage. I'm still running, you know, if you look at Strava, the last month has been the best month of training I've ever had. Probably averaged around 106 miles a week with 18,000 feet of vert per week. And mm-hmm. I'd never done that before. And like I was a little, like last week I kind of had a down week going into Speed Goat and I felt terrible, which is pretty typical for down weeks. Most athletes will say, I'm supposed to feel good, mm-hmm. but you're like expecting to feel good mm-hmm. when you finally realize like, hey, if you're running 5 miles a day or 15 miles a day, you're always tired. Like it's mentally and physically draining. But you kind of go through those little taper tantrums. And I think that, you know, this year it was just focusing cognizantly or, you know, kind of being cognizant that we need to be stronger on the uphills. Like I don't think there are any Europeans that can outrun a lot of us Americans, just like on a pure foot race basis, but you throw in the big climbs, which that's what this race is, you know, that's where it's going to kind of make or break the race. So I'm just trying to get used to that and wrap my head around, you know, how much climbing we have to do. And it's kind of been fun to embrace that a bit more. And I feel like Speed Goat went decently well. And I walked out of it feeling as though I was in control on the climbs. And that has more feet per mile on like a mile per mile basis than UTMB. And it's more technical than UTMB. So it was a nice little test run 5 weeks out from the big dance.
Yeah, you crushed it, Tim.
I didn't crush it, but it was fun.
But you said your strategy for Speed Goat, it was like start slow and power hike and then shred. And like, it seems like at UTMB last year, you closed so hard, you know, and you were like ripping on the downhills and everything and still had like tons of legs. And then, and then even at like, so even at Speed Goat, you were like flew past Sage. And, I mean, you finished like 7-8 minutes ahead of him on the downhill. You passed him.
I guess so. Yeah, I caught him at mile 27 with 5 miles to go. And I think, maybe there was like a 7-minute gap by the end. But
8 minutes.
I think it was 9, actually.
Oh, I heard it was 30 minutes or something.
Yeah.
No, Sage had a tough race. He stuck his nose in it where I didn't. And so we had totally different races, you know, and I'm excited for what he's going to do at UTMB. But that was the plan, as you said, that, you know, Mario and I were very cautious that, hey, Speed Goat's no joke. Like, that's a tough 50K. And if you don't play your cards right, you may dig yourself a hole and you may need more time to recover. And that's not what we wanted. We wanted to continue training these next 2 weeks because this is kind of like my prime period. And I felt like we executed it well where, you know, at the beginning I was probably in sixth or seventh place and going over the first summit over Hidden Peak. I maybe moved up into fourth, but I was 10 minutes behind those guys already, like 9 miles in. And I was okay with that. Like, I just kind of had to check my ego knowing that there was a bigger goal in mind. And at UTMB, as you mentioned, last year, I think looking in the last, like in the last 20 miles, no, the last like 12 miles, I think I ended up putting like 40 minutes on Zach. He was really hurting. And that kind of scares me to blow up that hard. So I'm normally a little more cautious. And I think actually I ran the numbers cause I'm a data geek. And I think from the first half to the second half of my UTMB race, I slowed down about 1% over like the entire race, which that I was really happy to see that where, you know, most people probably slow down like 20 to 50%, depending on how bad your race is, true. You know, it's so easy to get out too fast.
Weren't you 4 minutes behind second?
And that's
just
the thing.
Ran out of real estate.
Yeah. Like if it had been a 110 mile race, Demas was mine, but, it wasn't, you know, I mistimed my kick, but, hopefully I can improve upon that this year.
Hey, let's give Mario a shout out and some props. You guys both are coached by him. You know,
he's awesome.
What organization, if others, does he have coaches underneath him? If people are looking for coaches, what do you guys know about that?
I don't think he has coaches underneath him. Does he, Tim?
No, he just has his own kind of independent business now. And
I think his roster is full. Yeah, I barely squeezed in.
Yeah, I made the mistake of like talking about him too much, and I think he's collected quite a kind of corral of runners.
Yes.
Okay, so he doesn't need any help, is what you're saying?
No, well, he's a great.
You
follow
can reach
him.
Out, yeah.
Yeah, reach but, out.
And one thing I love about Mario is he's such a voice in the sport outside of just ultra running. Like you follow him for just like, you know, updates on road marathoning or track and field athletics, you know, to hot topics of doping. You know, I just think it's fascinating that he's a student of the sport, very knowledgeable in a lot of different areas and kind of a fun guy to listen to. He has the Morning Shakeout, a weekly editor or a weekly thing that he sends out to people's emails. That's if you're not on his list, you should be. It's fantastic. It's kind of like, you know, what's hot in the world of running each week and, you know, and with an opinion from him. And it's a great read.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, can we task you with putting that in the show notes?
I'm writing it right now.
Tim, I like what you said about like going into a race. It's better to go into a race 10% undertrained versus 1% overtrained.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I learned that in my marathon career. I had a great coach, Mike McKeeman, and he really kind of hammered it in that, hey, like if you're super fit, but you cross that line, even 1%, you're going to show up to the race and just, you know, you're busted. Like you're not going to make it past the 20 mile mark in a marathon and be able to finish it out. And a marathon is 26.2 miles. It doesn't matter how well you're doing at 24, you have to get to the end. And, you know, if you're a little undertrained, and you walk away feeling like, hey, I could do something different next time. I think mm-hmm. that's the perfect approach, and learn each and every time. You know, too often we see examples of, like, you know, people that go out and try and crush course records, and then they blow up, and then they come out and try yeah. and crush it again, and they blow up. And so, like, what are you learning? Like, I want to see yeah. you. Like, come on. Like, let's be, like, a little objective in this, and let's mm-hmm. kind of take this methodical learning approach. But, you know, that's my opinion, obviously. Like, and mm-hmm. you got to do what's right for you. But I think for the majority of people, taking that long-term approach to running, if it's 5Ks, marathons, or 100 milers, if you are you're willing to put in the time and slowly build and improve year after year, season after season, I think you're going to enjoy it more. You're going to minimize how many just epic bonks you have, and you're going to learn something along the way and not make excuses. Because personally, and I know I have a lot of friends, thinking back to my track running days, I never ran a good 5K because mm-hmm. I always went out too hard the first six laps, but I always blamed it on something, not myself. It was never my fault. And every time it was my fault. I just wasn't willing to take the blame. And I think, you know, in ultra running, like, we're afraid to take the blame. And so personally, that's how I deal with it. And I think it's kind of a neat way to, you know, kind of look at things.
But you're a big advocate on running within yourself. Like, you have a lot of control, like, especially how you, you know, played out UTMB last year, like, just coming stealth mode from behind. Like, you didn't even know you would really have a chance to podium until someone said so. And then it was like, game on, I'm going to hammer.
Yeah. And I think to that point, then, you know, maybe there are points that, like, you know, I don't have the Zach Miller mentality where he, mm-hmm. he just guts himself and he races to win. And I have so much respect for him for doing that. And there are times in my career where I will do that, but I kind of hold back, and they will come out every once in a while. And that's just kind of my personality. And I think I probably fit more of the mold that most people are, because most of us aren't running races to win races. We're running them for a variety of reasons. And one of them probably is to enjoy it somewhat. And I think you're going to enjoy the process more if you are a little more reserved, and if you display some emotional control. And I think that's an important thing to kind of learn. And you know, it doesn't always have to be there. And maybe sometimes I misjudge my kick, like at UTMB last year. But, you know, last year my goal was to finish my first 100 miler and hopefully be mm-hmm. competitive, but I wasn't trying to win the race. Like, Zach was mm-hmm. trying to win that race,
right?
And he put his nose in it, and he was so close. And, you know, he's going to get it right someday. But I think it's kind of neat that we have all those different personalities in the sport.
Mm. I love that.
Hey, let's get back to the race for 1 second. All of that was good stuff,
yeah.
But let's get back to the start of the race. If there's 2,200 people, how in the heck do you get yourself up to the front of that start line? I could see that could be quite a task in itself. What type of arrangements do they have for you fast folks?
So they do a pretty good job of, like, well, I think most in a race like that, it's kind of like a road marathon. You kind of self-regulate where you think you should be. And if there's ever a problem, personally, here's a tip that I do at road races. I'll do a stride. I'll just run out through the start line, like out 50 to 100 meters, kind of do some drills, and then run back, and then you're at the front. Like, you're and then you have to, like, just turn around and slowly back up into everyone. It's like, oh, sorry, guys. Like, here, I'm going to go ahead and get here. It's much easier than, like, if you're trying to, like, weasel your way in through the back and, like, pushing people out of the way. There aren't actual – well, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Sally, but I don't think there are corrals like the way some of these other races may have. Like,
well,
you know,
if you aren't, I guess if you're not professional or elite, then you actually, they just start lining up like hours and hours and hours before the race. But
okay.
The elite runners have the ability just to walk up and be in that front corral. So it's only divided into two sections. So there's the elite runners, which is probably, what do you think, like 200 people?
It's probably about that, yeah.
50 people. And then it's marked off by like a string behind us. But we all can walk up, you know, the race starts at 6, so we can walk up like at 5:40 and stand there. Whereas the people, the other 2,000 people, a lot of them have been sitting there for hours trying to get as close to the front as possible. So it's a little bit different of a setup. Now, there is no wave start. So as soon as it starts, like, it is it starts out like a 5K and it's almost impossible to avoid it. They say don't, you know, try not to run too fast in the beginning, but unless you want to get trampled, you know, it's a very narrow street. And there are thousands of spectators pressing in on our race path. And so your goal is just to get out of the city as fast as you can and then discipline yourself after that first mile or two to slow down and run your race. But you know, the first year I did it, I was like, everyone says it starts out too fast and you know, that everyone's running like a 5K, but it's like almost impossible to run it at a true like 100-mile pace. Like you have to like rip off that line. And the first year I did it, I had these water bottles with straws out of them. I tried doing something different with my pack. And within the first 5 feet of starting, one water bottle went flying out of my pack. And all I was thinking was like, I'm going to get disqualified. That's my other like half a liter of fluid. And it's getting kicked across the path. And I'm like diving for it as, you know, there's thousands of people running as fast as they can behind me. And somehow I grabbed it. But there isn't really like a true separation of corrals or anything like that. There's just we just kind of have the privilege of being able to come right before the race starts and stand in front of everyone. So,
you know, in wrapping up, what is one of your favorite things about running that race?
Tim?
I guess for me, it's being able to just get out and really spend time in big mountains. That's what drives me to do kind of these crazy events. And although there are so many people, and I have definitely a different experience than if someone was in the back of the or mid pack and maybe in a Congo line, like going up some of the the peaks. But like there was a true sense of just kind of being out there in the wilderness where you'd enter into like a small village or like one of the refugios and they have an aid station set up, you know, you're greeted by passionate people, but then you're back out on the trail by yourself. And I love that. And you're just out there. You have these incredible mountains surrounding you. Everywhere you look is beautiful. And there are places are along the course where you may enter just like this herd of cattle, like bighorn cattle that you're kind of running through, or I encountered several different ibex, like bighorn, you know, like mountain goats that yes. are on the course. And you know, it's neat to kind of just experience that stuff while you're in the middle of a race. And, mm-hmm. and to me that, you know, kind of erases all the pain that my legs may be feeling. I just kind of focus on like these unique experiences that you won't have for a while. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, I really love the whole week long celebration. I mean, it is, you know, I love competition. I love it when the competition is deep and it's people from all over the world. I mean, when it comes down to it, if you have the points and you're a competitive runner and you want to race it, you can. And I love how deep that competition is. It really shows who you are personally as a runner. It really challenges you. But I think like just that whole week, it is, you know, it's thousands of people in the city. And so you're able to connect with people all over the world and meet up with, you know, your favorite runners and just sit and have a coffee and wave to, you know, a bunch of friends walking by. And I also feel like regardless of who you run for, I mean, you know, Tim runs for Hoka now. I'm still on Nike. And even though we wear different shoe brands, like I feel like the Americans, like it doesn't matter what brand you run for. Like we're rooting for the American men. We're rooting for the American women. And we just have like this real sense of pride as a country going over there. And I think it's over 140, 160 countries that are represented there. And so it's almost like the closest thing to the Olympics that we could possibly mm-hmm. get. You get that buzz, the excitement, the support, the camaraderie. It is so fun. So even if, even if you can't be there racing or whatever, just to be there and to experience that, the true passion for the sport and just everybody that along the way, and then just actually racing it, running through three countries in the most beautiful mountains. It's just exhilarating. And these are the kind of things that you'll hold on to for the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I haven't had a good race there yet, but I've loved every moment that I've been able to be there. I'm super grateful. So, I'm really excited about getting back and, you know, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Tim.
I think that's great. And, you know, downtown Chamonix, it is basically just this, you know, festival of like people all week long. And it's and the downtown area is closed off to traffic. So it's only foot traffic. And so you have just this giant plaza that you're walking down all these different shops and like bakeries and eateries and places to hang out and have, you know, cafes, get some, you know, you have tons of gelato shops.
Gelato. Like,
so much. but you can just kind of hang out. And Chamonix sits in a valley where you're surrounded by Mont Blanc, which is 15,000 feet. And then the other side, like Le Flégier and the Brabant, like you're just in this, like just you're towered by, you know, peaks that go up 10,000 feet above you on either side. And you're sitting in the valley, and it's just a unique experience that you don't really have in the States anywhere. So it's just sort of a really like unbelievable place. It kind of feels magical. And then, like Sally said, you're walking around and there's so many Americans you end up running into. And, and you know, they're over the years, there've been a lot of people that have just traveled over there as kind of like this bucket list race. And I think it's definitely worth it. It's not like anything you're going to have in the States. And that's cool that in our sport, if you want this big event like that, you have it. Or if you want a little backyard brawl 50K, we have that also. And I think it's neat that we can select whatever interests us. And I think this is something worth checking out someday.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the United States, you get a belt buckle for finishing a race. What do you get over there?
A mangled piece of... No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No, so it's funny. I did my first 100-miler, and I still don't have a belt buckle. I can't participate in whatever that Western States, like, pre-lottery belt buckle day Friday is. Like, I don't have anything. I think... Or last year, we got a really cool...
it's handmade.
Like I think all finishers end up with some sort of branded apparel. Like we got really nice fleeces and then a really nice vest. But then for like the podium, we got these handmade, really pretty rad metal sculptures from a local artist that I tried putting on a belt, but it doesn't quite fit. So it kind of is funky.
They're like 12 inches tall.
But
how soon do you guys plan to go over? Like how early? Because I know like Stephanie's already there. Like some people go super early.
And I always get so jealous of people that can go over there 6 weeks before. But some of us have jobs and families.
Yeah. Yeah. I got lucky this year that my work has allowed me to take 3 weeks off. And so I'm going to get out there on the 15th. And it's kind of this weird date where it's too close to the race to really do any big training, but it's long enough ahead of time that I can just kind of relax and be a running bum for 2 weeks, which I'm looking forward to. You know, just kind
of. So, will you do any running there?
Oh,
yeah, I'll run every single day. Yeah. But like within 2 weeks, I'm starting to kind of taper a little bit, so my mileage is dropping in. And as I drop my mileage, I keep my intensity high, so I'll still have workouts, but I won't be doing, you know, like a 50K on the course. You know, it's too close to the race to do that. So it's just going to be little outings, kind of scoping out different areas of the course, but more just kind of having fun with it.
Yeah. You know, and I think what people don't realize too, especially if you're going over there for the first time, the excitement and the buzz and the amount of people is like nothing you've ever experienced. So it's really easy to be exhausted by that and overwhelmed by it. So being able to go out early is key because your brain and just the mental side of the race, you need to rest. And so I think that's a huge, you know, part of going into the race is allowing your brain to be rested and at peace. So, you know, going over there early is nice because you can kind of like ease into it and, you know, and get used to the time zone and all of that. I probably will head over there like seven days before the race. That's probably like the earliest that I'm able to, but I've done that last couple years and it's totally fine. Yeah, it works out good. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I think a week is if you can get out there, you know, 3 to 7 days before, it's probably perfect. You know, you don't have to acclimate to the elevation there. Like it's actually a lower elevation race for a mountainous race, but just getting the jet lag out of your legs, depending on how you travel, I think it's ample enough.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Right. Well, we enjoy the time that you guys spend with us and getting us up to speed on UTMB. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it, but a lot of us don't know enough about it. And the more I learn, the more I'm fascinated and want to see it.
It wanna
sounds
run
like
it.
A great, great race. Sally McCrae, best wishes to you. Tim Tolson, go out there and kill it again and stand on that podium and do it again. That's fantastic.
Thank you guys for having us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Michelle Barton, thank you very much for putting this together. You were the Scott's out on vacation. My head's buried in work, and you orchestrated this thing. So thank you for doing that.
So everybody, go out and run.
Very cool. Correct. Maintenant avec des euros, ce que je demande, ce sont des nids corrects. Les rues de Paris sont pleines de scouts. Y a plus de mobilettes, darwinisme industriel, du minitel à l'internet. Le 118, 118 a remplacé le 12. Et puis la carte de Moreno veut effacer le flou. Le temps passe, il efface ton radio comme 2000, ton tam tam, ton bebop, ton tatou, ton thermolactyle. À la télé y avait la 5 et puis TV6. Au ciné c'était Bébelle en bois de Genesis. Le Gore-Tex prend la place du Duffelcoat. Et ce sont des robots qui remplacent les cosmonautes. Y'a plein de philosophes mais plus de philosophie. Fuck la fausse philo, vive la Philadelphie. Parfois je pense au SVP 11-11. À mon vieux je s'immonde, aux hommes volants de follow. Allez à Jacques, ta messe. On vient de Budapest ou de Gare de l'Est. Alors carpe diem. Parce qu'il faut du temps pour les gens qui s'aiment. Allez à Jacques, ta messe. On vient de Budapest ou de Gare de l'Est. Alors carpe diem. Alors carpe diem. Alors carpe diem. Autant d'avant, Herbalife, Tupperware et Hamway. Y'avait des sacs orange à l'euro marché. Du top 7, des chewing-gum baraka, des trits, des bouteilles consignées, GVO, Préfontaine et Pichet. Des marchands de couleurs et dans la rue des rémouleurs. Le temps passe depuis la gaine 24 heures. Le rétro était en option sur les voitures. Et l'hiver, les gens jetaient des seaux d'eau sur les serrures. Les noms reviennent. Marie Besson pour une minute pour les femmes. Jacoule, croquant, chéri Bibi, capitaine flamme. Le temps passe, les pyramides mangent 10. Pendry Vox, cassette et vinyle, compact. Allez à Jacques, ta messe. On vient de Budapest ou de Gare de l'Est. Alors carpe diem. Parce qu'il faut du temps pour les gens qui s'aiment. Allez à Jacques, ta messe. On vient de Budapest ou de Gare de l'Est. Alors carpe diem. Alors carpe diem. Alors carpe diem. Dans un futur pourchassé par la synarchie, une élite de 12 cadres qui gère le monde et vit en autarcie. Ils ont capté nos droits et installé la fausse démocratie. M'accuse d'apostasie, les milices complices, elles parlent d'anarchie. Mais j'ai supporté le croyant, la croix, l'étoile et le croissant. Le sang croissant, mais l'agitation croissant. Ils récupèrent la foi, mettent des 4x3 du Christ. Tombe de faux évangélistes pour que j'adore l'antéchrist. Il y a des satellites, je cours si on m'alpade. C'est stalagougoulag et des faux aveux dans les mags. J'entre dans une classe et je me place près du radiateur. La troupe arrive en force et je suis face à des gladiateurs. Tu vois le calico, illico, j'entends les hélicos. Je tente pas de me débattre, ils ont des tas de balances illico. On analyse ma rétine, une erreur sur la personne. Je monte sur le pupitre et puis je crie freedom. Alors carpe diem, alors carpe diem, alors carpe diem. Allez à Jacques, ta messe.